Now, we'll need writers who can remember freedom, poets, visionaries, realists of a larger reality. I feel like in the discourse about immigration, so often it's the politicians whose voices and perspectives are uplifted. And with Unseen, what I'm really proud of is our filmmaking team is reflective of Pedro's life. Our film was led by a team of filmmakers who happen to be undocumented immigrants ourselves. Blind and disabled artists have also been an integral part of our filmmaking practice. And I feel like, how can we reclaim the narrative for ourselves instead of further uplifting the perspectives that politicians have about our community? How can we really lean on each other and amplify the voices and the ways that we understand our lives and the world? And I feel like because of the way that the film industry works, undocumented people, systems impacted people, people with disabilities are excluded from receiving resources to be able to make films. Because even for me to be able to make the film, I was excluded from so many grant-making opportunities because of citizenship and residency requirements that so many of these opportunities require. So
Seth,
we're really
Hernandez,
grateful for all the people that have supported us.
I want to thank you for being with us and congratulate you on Unseen, which just premiered on POV. You can now watch it online. We're going to do part two at democracynow.org. Unseen. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operation and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Policy and Governance Committee meets on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if the meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Boeing flights in and around Oregon see more malfunctions. A DNA match from chewing gum leads to the conviction of a Troutdale man in a 1980s cold case. And in international news, Hong Kong passes a new law cracking down on protests and dissent. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 19, 2024. I'm Eric Leuschner. A Boeing flight landed safely in Portland on Sunday after its inner windshield cracked during the descent. Alaska Airlines Flight 9 came in from Washington, D.C. on Sunday evening. No injuries were reported. It was a Boeing 737-800, which Alaska Airlines says has five-layer windscreens. The airline said in a statement, quote, "If an inner pane cracks, the other pane and layers can maintain cabin pressure," end quote. It's been a rough couple of months for Boeing flights, especially in the Pacific Northwest. On Friday, a Boeing United Airlines flight was found to have a missing panel on landing in Medford from San Francisco. Earlier this month, passengers on a flight out of Portland headed to Phoenix had to turn around because of fumes in the cabin. It was also a Boeing 737-800. Seven people, passengers and crew, requested medical evaluations, but no one was hospitalized. Earlier this month, the Federal Aviation Administration found that 737 MAX production process at Boeing and its supplier Spirit AeroSystems had, quote, "multiple instances where the companies failed to comply with manufacturing quality control requirements," end quote. Boeing whistleblower John Barnett was found dead last weekend, days before giving testimony in a safety lawsuit against the company. The issues at Boeing could mean higher prices for travelers this summer as airlines are delayed in purchasing new planes. Southwest Airlines has had to cut capacity, and Ryanair says European passengers will see higher prices because it can't get its hands on new planes. Boeing has a backlog of 6,000 orders, and competitor Airbus has a backlog of more than 8,000 planes. New analysis by Carbon Brief projects that a second Trump administration would create 4 billion additional tons of climate pollution. A second Biden administration is projected to reduce emissions, but still miss targets set for 2030. Eric Galatis has more.
As Americans begin to weigh their options in this year's presidential election, a new Carbon Brief analysis projects that a second Biden term would help reduce climate pollution, but the administration will still fall short of meeting its 2030 goals. Report co-author Simon Evans says, by contrast, a second Trump term that successfully rolls back Biden initiatives, including the Inflation Reduction Act as promised, would add 4 billion extra tons of fossil fuel pollution.
That's equivalent to the combined annual emissions of the EU and Japan. That amount of extra emissions, 4 billion tons of greenhouse gas emissions by 2030, that would cause global climate damages worth something like $900 billion.
Trump has repeatedly claimed that climate change is a hoax and advanced policies that increased crude oil drilling in order to maintain American energy dominance. Researchers project a second Trump term would wipe out all emission reduction gains made over the past 5 years by installing wind turbines, solar panels, and other clean energy technologies across the globe twice over. In the 20th century, Evans says nations controlling large fossil fuel reserves did hold significant economic and other advantages, but in the 21st century and beyond, he believes countries with large portfolios of clean energy will have the advantage.
And actually, clean energy technologies are a great way of bringing energy security because you're not relying on imports. You're just relying on the wind and the sun that you have in your own country. And, you know, the U.S. is certainly very well endowed with wind and solar resources.
4 billion tons is also equivalent to the combined annual emissions of the world's 140 countries with the smallest carbon footprints. Evans notes people who can't afford air conditioning to survive extreme heat or move away from areas prone to flooding and wildfire will continue to face the biggest threats.
You know, the people around the world that are least responsible for climate change, whether that's in the poorest countries in the world or the poorest people in the richest countries, those tend to be the people that are most exposed to the negative impact of climate change.
This is Eric Galatis for the Colorado News Connection.
A man living in Troutdale was found guilty in a 1980s cold case murder of a 19-year-old college student at Mount Hood Community College. Robert Plimpton, 60, was found guilty of first-degree murder in the death of Barbara Tucker. Tucker was sexually assaulted and killed the night of January 15, 1980, near the community college in Gresham. Gresham Police Detective Aaron Turnage told the court of the aftermath of the unsolved case, saying, quote, "The community was gripped in fear as to who was the suspect, what happened, why, a lot of unanswered questions. Gresham was a quiet town," end quote. Years later, a DNA profile of the suspect was created from samples from Tucker's autopsy. Plimpton lined up with the DNA sample, but to confirm it, Gresham police detectives tested a piece of chewing gum he spit on the ground. He was convicted on Friday and remains in custody. His sentencing is set for June. The Supreme Court weighs government influence on social media and who groups like the NRA can do business with. Biden signs an executive order to advance women's health research, and the White House tells Israel it's responsible for the Gaza humanitarian crisis. With more on the story, it's Farah Siddiqui with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We know that there's a lot of government encouragement around here. We also know that the platforms are actively content moderating, and they're doing that irrespective of what the government wants. So how do you decide that it's government action as opposed to platform action?
Justice Elena Kagan questions plaintiffs' lawyers in a case over how much the government can try to influence social media. Two states brought the case, arguing the Biden administration abridged the free speech of conservatives. The White House counters it just asked the platforms to remove posts on topics like COVID conspiracy theories and election disinformation. The court is also considering a second similar case. The NRA is arguing a New York State official inappropriately pressured banks and insurers to stop doing business with it. Although he says the ACLU often disagrees with the NRA, legal director David Cole calls it a free speech issue.
This was not about enforcing insurance law or mere government speech. It was a campaign by the state's highest political officials to use their power to coerce a boycott of a political advocacy organization because they disagreed with its advocacy.
President Joe Biden has signed an executive order to advance women's health research with $12 billion in funding and better data collection. His wife Jill introduced him at a White House Women's History Month commemoration and called the order an unprecedented step to correct a long-standing problem.
A study was conducted asking whether estrogen prevents heart attacks. 8,341 people were selected for that study. All of them were men.
While not directly related to IVF, the announcement comes as the Biden campaign makes reproductive health a focal point. Vice President Kamala Harris says ever since Roe v. Wade was overturned, voters have been troubled by threats to abortion access and reproductive care.
What kind of country do we want to live in? Do we want to live in a country of liberty, freedom, and rule of law, or a country of disorder, fear, and hate?
Following strikes on the Al-Shifa hospital where thousands are sheltering, the UN is describing a growing civilian crisis in Gaza, including an impending famine and widespread starvation. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan says Israel and its allies need to take responsibility.
That starts first and foremost with Israel, who has an obligation to step up and ensure that more is done to deliver food to starving people in northern Gaza. But it's also incumbent on us, the United States, and the rest of the international community to step up as well.
Sullivan says in a call with President Biden, Prime Minister Netanyahu agreed military intelligence and humanitarian officials will go to Washington to discuss a threatened Rafah offensive. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Portland Pickles are opening a sports bar in North Portland this Thursday night, just in time for March Madness. The bar is located on North Mississippi Avenue across from Mississippi Studios. Alan Miller is the owner of the Portland Pickles baseball team and the new pub. He says he's excited to unveil the new sports bar to the community. His goal for the new gathering place is to bring fans together, even if they like different teams. The numerous TV screens will feature international sports like European rugby and Australian rules football. They will also show familiar sports like minor league baseball. The bar offers local craft beers and specialty cocktails. The menu includes exclusive stadium hot dogs, so community members can enjoy Fenway Franks or Dodgers dogs right here in Portland. The Portland Pickles Public House is located at 39 North Mississippi Avenue in Portland. It's officially the first week of spring, and for many, that means spring cleaning. But a New Mexico study probes why so many people find it difficult to part with things they no longer need or use, especially one-third of Americans who rent storage units or plan to do so in the near future. KBOO reporter Birdie has the details.
Spring is often a time when many of us get rid of unwanted stuff, but one New Mexico expert says that's harder than it sounds for people who are addicted to buying or keeping items they don't need. University of New Mexico marketing professor Catherine Roster has spent almost two decades researching clutter, or excessive acquisition, and people's difficulty discarding things. Her research shows more than half of all garages in the country are not being used to park cars, but instead to store the residents' clutter.
We live in a culture of overconsumption. Some have called it the throwaway society, but it's really not always just a throwaway society because there are many individuals who have a difficult time throwing things away.
One study found that a fifth of all Americans pay a monthly fee for a storage unit, on average $120 per month, and another 14% plan to rent storage in the future. Roster says those who live with excessive clutter should not be confused with hoarders, because hoarders don't see clutter as a problem. Roster says many antique and secondhand store owners say they see the same folks every week, always looking for a bargain or adding to a collection they already don't have room for. Later, she says people have trouble deciding whether to get rid of items, even those without sentimental value, because they fear they'll need them later. But as people age, Roster says, that can create a significant hardship for family members.
We just really need to be mindful of the burden of the things that we're carrying, not only for ourselves, but for others, and to take the steps to start making more room in our life for relationships, experiences, and less time with our stuff.
She says for many people, acquiring more things is a mood enhancer, but the clutter it creates can cause anxiety. It can also lead to isolation, since people living alone might feel embarrassed to have others over or feel the need to hide the clutter out of sight. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Birdie.
Hong Kong lawmakers just approved a new national security measure that grants the government more power to squash dissent. It was passed unanimously, and the law is widely seen as the latest step in a sweeping political crackdown triggered by pro-democracy protests in 2019. The Safeguarding National Security Bill expands the authorities' ability to prosecute citizens for offenses like colluding with external forces to commit illegal acts, as well as charge them with treason, insurrection, espionage, and disclosing state secrets. Beijing imposed a similar security law in 2020, which has already largely silenced opposition voices in Hong Kong. Experts are worried that the new law will further erode civil liberties promised when the former British colony returned to Chinese rule in 1997. The law will take effect Saturday. Some provisions even allow criminal prosecutions for acts committed elsewhere in the world. Hong Kong has changed dramatically since the major 2019 street protest challenged China's rule over the territory. Many leading activists have been prosecuted, while others have sought refuge abroad. Pro-democracy media such as Apple Daily and Stand News have been shut down. Business people and journalists are worried the law is broad enough to adversely affect their day-to-day work. Elsewhere, the bill's passage quickly drew criticism. The United Nations denounced the accelerated adoption of the bill as, quote, a regressive step for the protection of human rights in Hong Kong. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Coast Range Radio. At 6 o'clock, it's Transpositive PDX. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 46. It's the last of the sunny skies for a while. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with a high of 57 degrees. Today in history, in 1918, the U.S. Congress establishes time zones and approves daylight savings time. The quote of the day is from 14th Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Earl Warren, who was born today in 1891. Warren said, quote, many people consider the things government does for them to be social progress, but they regard the things the government does for others as socialism. Montana created a task force on missing and murdered indigenous people in 2019, but hiring issues have meant the group hasn't met since last summer. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Montana's Missing Persons Task Force has not met since last summer, despite the state legislature funding the group for the next decade. Montana Public Radio's Ellis Julin reports the Department of Justice was delayed in hiring a lead position for the work.
State lawmakers last year passed two bills carried by Montana's American Indian Caucus to help missing and murdered people in Montana. But the state's Justice Department did not hire a leader for the task force until later this month and hasn't spent any of the funding allocated for training local search and rescue groups. According to 2023 state data, Indigenous people make up nearly 7% of the population, but make up a quarter of Montana's missing persons cases. Montana originally created an MMIP task force in 2019 to address the ongoing crisis. Now, with a full-time coordinator hired, the state is redoing the makeup of the group to run for the next 10 years. A spokesperson for the department said with the coordinator hired, they're in the process of appointing members and reaching out to tribes to nominate representatives for the Missing Persons Task Force. Montana's Department of Justice says it expects to have the group's first meeting this summer and then begin training search and rescue groups in the fall. For National Native News, I'm Ellis Julin.
Getting Native voters to the polls and tribal issues are among priorities of tribal leaders across the country. The Native vote was among topics at this year's National Congress of American Indians Winter Session in Washington. Andy Vigliotti has a story from Washington about tribal resilience despite concerns ahead of November's election.
As election 2024 heats up, many Native Americans are already feeling neglected. Michelle Downey is a tribal council member of California's Round Valley Indian Tribal Administration. She says candidates need to visit Indian country.
The thing is that nobody's coming to us to say what they're going to be doing to for us as a Native community. We're one of the largest reservations in Northern California, and we have 5,000 tribal members. So I would think that it would only benefit them when they would come to us.
Nationwide, Republicans have tried to unwind mail-in voting measures and have enacted more restrictive voter ID laws. Anissa Martin is an organizer with Indian Collective from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in South Dakota. She says new barriers only compound old struggles.
My res is like over 2 million acres, and transportation access is a huge thing with voting.
Martin says IDs matter.
I don't think they allow tribal IDs to vote, which has been a huge problem.
Genocide is on the minds of many Native youths who feel solidarity with the people of Gaza, according to NCAI Youth Commission co-president Yananawi Logan.
We cannot remain silent or pay no heed to the massacre in Gaza when our ancestors suffered a similar genocide.
Ashley Hemmers is an enrolled member of the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe. She says no matter who wins in November, tribes aren't going anywhere.
We always say at Fort Mojave we want partners that respect tribal sovereignty. So if you respect tribal sovereignty, that's what we're looking for. It'll make our consultation process easier. If you don't respect it, then it just means that we have a capacity gap and we'll either have to help you understand or wait you out.
For National Native News, I'm Andy Vigliotti in Washington.
The University of New Mexico is celebrating 20 years of offering a Bachelor of Arts in Native American Studies. An event will be held next week in Albuquerque to mark the milestone with the theme Looking Back, Moving Forward, 20 years of the Native American Studies Bachelor of Arts degree. The symposium will feature alumni to discuss how they're using their degrees. They also hope to inspire others to learn more about the program. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Two new papers from the Campaign for College Opportunity call for more investment in student financial aid and universal FAFSA application policies. Suzanne Potter has more.
Each spring, hundreds of thousands of California high school seniors have to figure out if they can afford to go to college in the fall. And two new reports from the Campaign for College Opportunity look at how to make higher ed more affordable. The feds recently launched a simpler financial aid application, but the rollout has been rocky. Deja Brown, a student at College of the Desert in the Coachella Valley, says programs that help with tuition, books, housing, food, and transportation make all the difference.
If we want to achieve statewide goals like 70% college attainment while closing equity gaps, we need to prioritize affordability and revolutionize financial aid.
The first study calls on Congress to better fund Pell Grants, which serve students whose families make under $40,000 a year. 32% of white students receive a Pell Grant, but that number is 60% for black students, 50% for Latino students, 45% for Native American students, and 39% for Native Hawaiians and Pacific Islanders. Study co-author Emmanuel Reyes with the Institute for College Access and Success notes that Pell Grants cover less than a third of the cost of college and calls on lawmakers to take action.
They can double the award. They can restore automatic inflation adjustments. They can fund those Pell Grants entirely through mandatory spending. They can expand eligibility to undocumented students. And they can eliminate taxation of the Pell Grant when used to cover any non-tuition costs.
Christopher Nellum with Education Trust West co-authored the second brief. It praises California's new law requiring all high school students to fill out applications for federal or state student aid.
That means there needs to be enough counselors engaging with young folks. We need schools and districts to have meaningful partnerships with the community college, with the universities in their area.
Studies show that students who fill out the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, enroll in college at a significantly higher rate than those who do not. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
Which actions benefit the climate most? An online tool called En-ROADS helps communities understand which policies will help the most. Dr. Anthony Leisowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Setting clean energy goals, pledging to plant billions of trees, mandating energy efficiency improvements. Lots of policies can reduce global warming, and it can be hard to know which are the most effective. So Climate Interactive and the MIT Sloan Sustainability Initiative created a free online simulation tool called En-ROADS.
To help people understand what policies are available and what kind of impact that they will have in terms of achieving desired climate goals.
Michael Overend, a volunteer with the nonprofit Citizens Climate Lobby, leads community workshops using En-ROADS. Users choose from a menu of climate policies, such as charging carbon polluters a fee or subsidizing EV purchases, and they can tweak variables like the amount charged on a ton of carbon. The tool provides instant feedback on how those policies would affect global temperature, sea level rise, and other outcomes if they were implemented worldwide.
It can be used to spark discussion among our leadership. It can be used to help educate community members
and inform action on the path toward a safer future. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
The House of Representatives has passed a bill that would order the Chinese-owned TikTok either to be sold or banned. National security is the main argument for the bill, but issues of free speech, government interference, and effectiveness argue otherwise. President Biden favors the bill. Donald Trump opposes it. Now we go to Global Citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone. The Chinese-owned TikTok has been under attack throughout the last two U.S. administrations on the argument that data collection of American users would threaten national security. I've yet to see a persuasive argument that it does, but no matter. In an election year, arguments count far less than posturing, and in this case, the bipartisan consensus on the China threat is winning. My message to TikTok, says Congressman Mike Gallagher of Wisconsin, a leading China hawk, is break up with the Chinese Communist Party or lose access to your American users. An overwhelming majority in the House of Representatives agreed, voting to demand the sale of TikTok to a U.S. entity in 6 months, or, if a sale cannot be made, a total ban on it. The bill may not pass in the Senate, however. President Biden has indicated he will sign the bill. His administration has provided special intelligence briefings to legislators to win support for TikTok divestment. By the way, the Biden campaign has a TikTok site. Donald Trump once was also against TikTok. During his administration, he made a failed effort to close it down. Now he wants to have it both ways, knowing of TikTok's popularity. He says TikTok is a national security threat, but also says it's so popular that closing it down would cause young people to go crazy. The real reasons for Trump's position are probably twofold. The CEO of ByteDance, TikTok's parent company, is a major contributor to his campaign. And Facebook, a chief competitor, is, to quote Trump, an enemy of the people. Among the problems presented by the House bill are free speech limitations, government overreach, and data security. The American Conservative Union and the American Civil Liberties Union have both urged Congress to reject the bill. Expressing the progressive view, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said she voted against the bill, saying, quote, "This bill was incredibly rushed, from committee to vote in 4 days with little explanation. There are serious antitrust and privacy questions here, and any national security concerns should be laid out to the public prior to a vote." Other legislators said they were unconvinced by the administration's briefing on TikTok and warned that if TikTok can be banned by the government, so can other apps. One Democratic representative from California said, quote, "Banning TikTok won't protect Americans from targeted misinformation or misuse of their personal data, which American data brokers routinely sell and share. This bill is a blunt instrument for serious concerns, and if enacted, would mark a huge expansion of government power to ban apps in the future," unquote. Finally, we may wonder how much safer our personal data would be in the hands of an American social media company that already exploits our data for its own ends. Sarah Jacobs, Democrat of California, said, "Not a single thing that we heard in today's classified briefing was unique to TikTok. It was things that happen on every single social media platform. Those things include sharing data with advertisers and allowing all manner of lies and deceptions to appear on Facebook, Google, and other sites. They strip mine our data to make money," says one opinion writer for the New York Times. China's response was that the U.S. was engaged in bullying. A spokesman made a global capitalist argument. The U.S. was disrupting international markets and sabotaging the international economic trade order. Beijing forgot to mention that YouTube, Facebook, and Instagram are banned in China. Meanwhile, according to David Sanger, the New York Times national security expert, the idea of selling TikTok to a U.S. company makes no sense. Quote, "TikTok has far less to do with who owns it than it does with who writes the code and algorithms that make TikTok tick," unquote. The algorithms are owned by ByteDance, and the Chinese government decides whether and when the algorithms shall be granted a license for sale to outsiders. Thus, says Sanger, quote, "few expect those licenses to be issued," meaning that selling TikTok to an American owner without the underlying code might be like selling a Ferrari without its famed engine, unquote. From that angle, the only option left is a ban, which in an election year and 170 million TikTok users is surely a bad idea. The underlying issue in this long-running battle is the technological competition between China and the U.S. Just as the Biden administration is imposing export controls on U.S. high technology transactions with China, the Chinese are withholding their codes from the U.S. Both sides are playing the national security game to justify protecting technological secrets and denying certain technologies to the adversary. The TikTok debate is caught up in this high-stakes game, much like artificial intelligence, robotics, and other technologies of the future. But TikTok has one big advantage, 170 million votes. I'm Mel Gertoff for The Global Citizen. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, March 19, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast